Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. This week, Iranian negotiators proposed a set of confidence-building measures aimed at ending the decade-long deadlock over the country's nuclear program. The measures were revealed at a two-day meeting in Geneva with the five permanent Security Council members and Germany, a group known collectively as the P5+1. The talks closely followed a series of positive diplomatic steps between the Islamic Republic and the West. What started as an exchange of letters last month between President Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani ultimately led to a 15-minute phone call between the two, marking the first direct talks between the leaders of the two nations since 1979. That same week, Secretary of State John Kerry met privately with his Iranian counterpart. Our guest today on Global Journalist will put these developments in perspective and discuss the likelihood a nuclear agreement could be reached in the near future. But first, World Watch with Raymond Tungekar.
In the Philippines, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake damaged buildings and left over 100 dead. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake was centered below the island of Bohol, roughly 620 kilometers southeast of Manila. The earthquake came less than a week after a typhoon killed at least 13 people and displaced nearly 50,000 in the country. In the Mediterranean, a ship carrying migrants capsized between Sicily and Malta on Friday, killing at least 27 people. At least 200 passengers were rescued. The majority of the passengers were Syrian and left Africa from Libya. The shipwreck occurred a few days after a previous boat disaster claimed the lives of more than 300 migrants near the Italian island of Lampedusa. In Myanmar, police have arrested four suspects in Yangon in connection with a recent string of explosions in the city. A time bomb was hidden in the bathroom of an American family's hotel room. The bomb exploded, injuring one. Following the explosion, three more bombs went off in tourist locations across the city. And that's it for World Watch.
Joining me now to discuss the negotiations around Iran's nuclear program are a journalist and a policy analyst who've been following the story closely. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of the book Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, A Primer. Nigar Mortazavi is an Iranian-American freelance journalist based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The two words that I have seen repeatedly in the reporting of recent events are cautious optimism. How would you characterize not just this week's events, but those of recent weeks, Phyllis?
I think cautious optimism is pretty appropriate. It's important to recognize that what's on the table right now are not completely new ideas. What we're hearing about the new Iranian position that has to do, among other things, with a willingness to sign on to the additional protocol of the existing non-proliferation treaty, of which, of course, Iran is already a signatory, is something Iran offered back in 2005. What's new is the political atmosphere surrounding all of this, the willingness of the U.S. administration to go ahead with these meetings, challenging AIPAC and other parts of the pro-Israel lobby, challenging the hawkish contingent in Congress, in the Senate, and elsewhere, and show up in Geneva, among other things, with a number of sanctions experts among the delegation. So there's a shift in the political scene, more than brand new ideas. There's a brand new willingness to hear and potentially act on some of those new ideas.
And Nagar, admittedly, the optimism, or at least the reporting of such, is coming from many Western sources. Curious about, from the Iranian perspective, does that optimism pervade quite as broadly?
Definitely. I mean, I could even say the optimism is stronger on the Iranian side. Obviously, the Iranian diplomats are telling everyone that the negotiations have been very constructive. And I feel like it's not just the outcome, the very outcome of this negotiation, but it's the overall mood on the streets of Tehran and overall in Iran that has injected this optimism since the election of Hassan Rouhani, because honestly, the Iranian public didn't really expect their votes to be counted since what happened in 2009. So people sort of just put their faith in the ballot again. And then Hassan Rouhani came out of the ballot, which looked like their votes had been counted. And since then, this sense of optimism has started. I was speaking to a young man in Tehran, and he said, even though nothing fundamentally has really changed yet, but this optimism that we're going to have a better future within the next 6 months or next year is going to be better than this year is just so strong with people that this did not exist, let's say, 6 or 10 months ago.
And that optimism and the feeling of breakthrough, and we will address the economic sanctions throughout the course of this show, but those sanctions are felt in a very, very real way, and many have pointed to those as sort of a motivating factor on the Iranian side. Can you extrapolate or elaborate on that?
I would say maybe the most important demand on the Iranian side is a relief for the sanctions. That is coming from the public. So if this foreign policy team headed by Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, can make a breakthrough that would bring in results, that would be an easing of sanctions, that would be something that has a lot of support within the public. I was speaking to an Iran analyst the other day, and he said this foreign policy that we see right now, I would say, is the best that the Islamic has ever produced, or maybe he even said could ever produce. So if this foreign policy team, this negotiation team, can't bring the results, then there's not a lot of hope for any other or better team to do this. So I'm very optimistic, and I think the feeling among the public, the people that I speak to in Iran, is also a lot of optimism and, I would say, faith in this team bringing in tangible results.
Reuters columnist and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rhodes spoke with producer Zahra Rasool about the key stumbling blocks in these negotiations.
I think there are two main stumbling blocks. One would be the level of IAEA inspections. There's a level of inspections that the IAEA has been demanding, which would be inspections anywhere in Iran within only 24 hours notification. The Iranians have never agreed to that. And then the second sticking point is that there's roughly 400 pounds of uranium that the Iranians have enriched to 20% that the U.S. and European officials and Israelis are very suspicious of. For power, you really need to enrich only to around 5%. The Iranians say they've enriched the 400 pounds to 20% for medical research purposes, which is true, but the concern is that they could continue that enrichment process up to 95%, which is weapons grade, very quickly.
Phyllis Bennis, your reaction to what David Rhodes said, but also to the idea of stumbling blocks. You had mentioned earlier the fact that this is something that certain parties within these negotiations have wanted for years, and yet it took a little while for political will to be established. Is that still one of the predominant stumbling blocks here?
Absolutely. I think that what we're dealing with, we just heard from David Rhodes, the question of potential problems that Iran will have to deal with, but there's a whole other set of problems on the U.S. side, one of which is the congressional stranglehold on the administration. The problem the administration faces is that Congress controls some of them. They were imposed as laws, which really restricts what the administration can do. It can't simply lift all the sanctions, even if it felt, as many of us do, that they are counterproductive, illegal, and immoral in the sense of targeting the population rather than anyone responsible for any, quote, bad actions. So that's one problem we face, the congressional stranglehold. Another potential problem has to do with Israel. Despite the fact that the Obama administration has been willing to move ahead on these talks with Iran, despite the opposition of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, and, of course, AIPAC, the most important centerpiece of the pro-Israel lobbies in the U.S., that's a good thing. They've been willing to say, no, we're not going to listen to those lobbies. There is no doubt that if anything begins to emerge that looks like a significant bargain with Iran, that there will be outrage from Tel Aviv, and the result in Washington will be, what can we give Israel to assuage them? What can we give Israel to assuage its supporters here so they don't try to punish us next election cycle?
to that issue of Israel, our producer talked with David Rode about that subject.
There's many members of Congress that agree with, you know, Israel's suspicion that this effort to have these negotiations is just a delaying tactic, that Iran will, you know, be like North Korea and then Pakistan before it, where they'll deny that they're pursuing a nuclear weapon and, you know, and then suddenly announce that they have one. So they are significant in that they, you know, members of Congress could refuse to release the sanctions.
The issue of trust seems to come up fairly often in this topic, for sure. And one RAND policy analyst said, "I don't think it's a matter of trust. My advice would be to distrust Islamic Republic, but to verify their intent. With President Rouhani's election in June, we're seeing a change in Iran's approach to the nuclear issue, very different than the policies pursued by the former president." With that said, Nagar, the distrust and certainly the voice of Israel in all of this remains quite impactful.
Definitely. I mean, the voice that is coming out of the Israeli administration right now, the calling the Iranian president a wolf in sheep's clothing and asking the West to not trust this administration, I think part of it, I would say, is a sort of a media or maybe even like a bargaining push to you know, try to get the most out of what Iran has to offer on the table and the least of what West is going to offer to Iran. But overall, my perception is if the West and Iran, especially the U.S. and Iran, can come to terms in this sort of non-existent relationship that started with that phone call after 3 decades, if this goes on and some kind of a relationship starts, I think it would ultimately benefit Israel as well. Because even though the two sides, Iran and Israel, have been benefiting from calling out each other and creating an enemy, or I would even say not a really true enemy, but just the image of an enemy on the other side, I think that era is over, at least from the Iranian public. From this vote that they cast for a moderate, I think the era of tension with the region and with the world, at least the message from people, is that this era should be over, and Iranians want more dialogue, more relations with the world, West included, and especially the U.S. And I think things would be going more towards that direction, and it will benefit both nations, I'm sure, Iran and Israel, and even the U.S.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we're discussing this week's talks in Geneva about Iran's nuclear program. I'm joined by Phyllis Bennis, author of the book Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a primer, and also by freelance journalist Nagar Mortazavi. So there are certainly, and we started the show by talking about the possibilities of a positive outcome, of optimism. But given the track record, and that's something else that we've discussed, of disagreement between the U.S. and Iran, we asked David Rode if it was realistic to expect a positive outcome.
State Department officials I've spoken with say it is possible to have aggressive inspections that will limit Iran's ability to build a nuclear bomb and allow it to have a nuclear power program. So there is a way that this can be done, and it would help all sides to really push forward as quickly as possible with detailed negotiations to see if those kind of inspections are really possible.
Phyllis Bennis, let's talk about who needs this deal more. We've talked about the climate in Washington, and we've talked about the fact that that there may be more will on either side. But is there a perception that one side needs this more than the other?
I think that the reality is both sides need this. Both sides have an interest in it. You know, Iran is clearly having a devastating impact on the economy to face these crippling sanctions. And although the U.S. claim that Iran is thoroughly isolated in the world isn't quite true, there's other countries do not isolate Iran the way the United States does. But what's also true is that the power of the U.S. economy, the U.S. banking system, the use of the dollar as the main currency, et cetera, has an enormous impact on countries that the U.S. sanctions, because the price is paid by other countries who are prohibited from dealing with Iran, other banking systems from Europe, from Japan, from Africa, from anywhere else, pay a price if they deal with Iran. So, you know, there's an enormous cost being paid by the people of Iran for these sanctions. There's no question that this is something very important. It's also true that in Iran, the issue of national dignity is very, very important. And the willingness of the Rouhani government to come in with a very different approach than his predecessor, but to say, you know, we want to negotiate, we want to end the sanctions, but we're not going to give up the rights that we have under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which people should remember, Iran as a signatory has all the rights identified in Article 4 of the treaty, which, among other things, says they have the right not only to access nuclear power, which is the word that President Obama used, but they have the right to produce nuclear power and to have all of the technology necessary to do that. The U.S. can posture about how, well, we don't want them, we don't trust them, so we don't think they can. But the problem is the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is part of international law. The U.S. shouldn't just get to say which parts of it will be implemented or not. On the other hand, the U.S. obligations under Article 6 have been ignored for years, as well as those of the other permanent members of the Security Council, what we might call, as well as the PERM 5, they're also the NUKE 5. They are all obligated under Article 6 of the NPT to get rid of their nuclear arsenals. That was part of the deal. The U.S. and its allies basically laugh at that obligation. So we see enormous pressures. I mean, there's political pressures continuing on the administration. Just yesterday, former President George Bush met with the Council of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations to urge them to continue the pressure against a deal with Iran, a clearly unhelpful position for a former president to take on the eve of serious new negotiations by his successor. But, you know, we see a new possibility, and I think there are interests in both sides for the U.S. ending this the ratcheting up tension that is creating enormous pressures on the Obama administration to go further, to use force. We saw this rise in the Bush administration in 2006. We saw it again with the Obama administration in its first year in 2009. And we're seeing it again, that there was, until just a few months ago, there was another round of rising tension, rising pressure, saying you've got to strike Iran first. We've got to support Israel if they want to strike. And the Obama administration has resisted that pressure. But as we see in Syria, they're not always able or willing to resist that pressure for long. So I think on both sides, there's an eagerness to put this escalating tension behind them and to move on to some kind of a normalized relationship. The question is, on the U.S. side, will there simply be too much political pressure to prevent the logical outcome from happening?
To the issue of a doubled standard, David Rode commented on the fact that there does seem to be this sort of dual standard when it comes to the nuclear issue.
There's an argument for a double standard, but I do think that Iran's behavior under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, you know, has created legitimate suspicions about, you know, what is their goal? Will they be a stabilizing player in the region or not? You know, it could be a double standard, but Ahmadinejad's history, I think, really hurt the credibility of the Iranian argument on that score.
Nigar, your comments on that and how that is perceived in Iran.
I agree with David, and also another point he said before, that the 2013 election is a continuation of the Green Movement in 2009, which was also, I would say, a movement to get Mahmoud Ahmadinejad out of office and to vote a more moderate voice into presidency. This is the vibe that we're getting from the Iranian public. In essence, the 2013 presidential election was sort of a referendum, a nuclear referendum for the Iranian public as well, because we have to pay attention. The head of the negotiation team was a presidential candidate. So Saeed Jalili, who was a competitor of Hassan Rouhani, was the embodiment of everything the negotiations with the West had been in the past few years. And he was put to basically the judgment of the public, and he became one of the very least popular candidates in the presidential election. So that was a very clear message, I would say, from the Iranian public to the ruling elite.
Before we continue our discussion, a reminder that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, our website features a timeline of U.S.-Iranian relations over the last 30 years and a summary of the sanctions against Iran. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or on our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. So we talked a little bit about the support that Rouhani might be receiving. Does that support extend all the way to the Supreme Leader and to hardliners? Nigar?
I would say for the first time in a very, very long period of time, it seems that a moderate president is getting support from the hardliners. I wouldn't say the entire hardliner camp, but at least from the Supreme Leader, who is right now surprisingly serving as sort of a middle ground between the very far side of the hardliners and the moderates who are who have the administration and are in power. And this was not the case. It's good to refer back to President Khatami's time. It was not the case during President Khatami. He did not have as much support from the hardliner camp and even from the Supreme Leader. And this is something that I would say a winning card or an upper hand that President Rouhani has now. It's a combination of the situation of the years of experience, I would say, that the hardliners have been going through, and also the fact that President Rouhani and his administration overall are more presenting themselves as moderate, and so therefore a little bit closer to the hardliner camp, at least as far as their presentation goes, as opposed to the reformists who were clearly very further from the hardliner camp and I would say closer to the demands of the public, who have been pushing these sort of progressive demands for the past, I would say, two decades in the Iranian politics. So right now we're at a very critical, I would say, balancing point that President Rouhani has found sort of a balance between the hardliners in power and the public and their demands. And well, we can see if he can keep that balance, because I think it's a very difficult balance to keep. And he, so far, he's done pretty well, but it's only been a few months, and we'll see what happens. And by hardliners, I don't just mean the hardliners in Iran. I mean hardliners in Washington and Tel Aviv can also play a role in sort of pushing him off of this balance.
Phyllis Benesch, let's talk about what comes next. There are negotiations again in a couple of weeks now. And what do you anticipate might break a logjam or be seen as substantive progress that could come out of those negotiations?
Well, I think that Iran has already taken the first step towards making clear how substantive these talks are by posing that their own willingness to sign on at the end. They're not prepared to do it now, but making clear that they are prepared to sign on at the end of this process to what's known as the additional protocol of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The significance of that is that it requires much more intrusive inspections of the nuclear facilities of every member state. Iran had agreed to act on the requirements of the protocol back in 2005. It hadn't signed it, but it was allowing it to govern its relationships with the UN watchdog agency, the nuclear watchdog agency, the IAEA. And that meant that they were able to do spot inspections with only 2 hours' notice, that kind of thing. But when it was then the Europeans who were negotiating for the main powers, they basically refused to acknowledge that that was of any significance, and eventually Iran withdrew its activities around that and said, no, we haven't signed it and we're not going to act on it. The fact that they have now said they will sign that at the end of this process is very important in terms of laying out what's the end game here. Part of the problem has been that the U.S. in particular has refused to say what the end game is. Are they prepared to acknowledge that Iran is a signatory of the NPT and therefore has certain rights, including the right to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes? Are they prepared to say that Iran is a major power in the Middle East who needs to be included? So for things, for example, in the Syria negotiations, it was one of these preposterous, ridiculous, outrageous things that would be laughable if it wasn't so serious. The U.S. spent months trying to prevent any involvement of Iran in the peace talks over Syria, despite the fact that Iran is a major player in terms of providing weapons to the regime, et cetera, and that if you're serious about diplomacy, you have to have everybody at the table. The U.S. was refusing to acknowledge that. So to me, the next step for indicating seriousness of purpose has to come on the U.S. side. They have to make clear that the sanctions will be lifted quickly and directly in response to Iranian actions. What they've done so far is say, well, we're not making any promises. We're going to wait and see. We're going to wait and see what Iran does. We're not going to commit to anything. That's not going to work. That's not going to work. If they're serious about the diplomacy, not only do they have to go to the table, they have to put on the table what's their end game. What are they working towards? And then they can get together and figure out how to get there. What's the time frame? Iran has made one gesture. The U.S. needs to make another. Then what happens next? But first, there has to be a willingness to say, what's the end game? Are we going to have a grand bargain? Are we going to really try to normalize relations between the U.S. and Iran? Or is this limited to what will amount to simply a temporary lessening of tensions, and they'll ratchet up again a year later?
And most analysts would agree with you that this quickly needs to move from the stage of overtures to substantive progress on many fronts. Phyllis Bennix is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of the book Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a Primer. Thank you for being with us. And Nigar Mortazavi is an Iranian-American freelance journalist based in Washington, D.C. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Zahra Rasool was the lead producer this week. Stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.
And now Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Casey Morell. Today's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists just issued its first ever report on the relationship between the Obama administration and the press. Leonard Downey Jr., the former executive editor of The Washington Post and author of the report entitled The Obama Administration and the Press, says that the current government has started an unprecedented war on leaks that threatens the future of investigative journalism. In his report, Downey charged the president with failing to uphold early promises to increase government transparency and openness. The argument is backed by input from prominent journalists and editors like David E. Sanger, the former Washington correspondent of The New York Times. Sanger described the Obama administration as the most closed, control-freak administration I've ever covered. CPJ reported a total of 8 government-related criminal prosecutions under the 1917 Espionage Act over the past 5 years. 6 were leaks from government employees and 2 from contractors. Only 3 such charges were ever made in previous U.S. administrations. For more information on these and other stories involving press freedom around the world, please visit our website. That's globaljournalist.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morell.